All right, we're continuing on this section from 8 to 17. I have 18 to 23 here. I have some hard copies of this, and I sent it out as well. So if you prefer the electronic version, don't need that. But you will notice on here that I got a little smarter the way I did it. I actually put, instead of focus and apply, I put gleanings down here. So I thought that would be more appropriate. I think what we'll do tonight is just, I'm going to read 8 through 17. I'm going to assume that you kind of know what the rest of the story is by now, or at least what came before. Most all of you have been in here, and most of you are aware of the the story anyway. I mean, what happens. Before we do that, Tyler, would you just...
Sure, that's great.
Okay, so Naomi had a relative, we're told in verse 1 of chapter 2. We kind of get introduced to Boaz. And then Ruth the Moabite, she decides to go out into the field. So she takes the initiative to go out and do some gleaning. And Naomi encourages that. It's several interesting things in here, but we're going to pick it up from verse 8. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? When you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servants, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening, and she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Okay, do you guys have any questions? We talked about this, we started this text on Sunday. Anybody have any unanswered questions? I know we got into the whole thing of whether she was pretty or not, so we're going to try to avoid that one. But anything else that's not off the... Did you write down anything that you had a question about? No, that's good. You guys got it all figured out here. That's good to know. He tells Boaz, of course, now, it's interesting, if you go up to verse 5, it says, Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of reapers, whose young woman is this? Who is this? I mean, he doesn't ask about how the harvest is going or anything. He just says, "Who's this woman over here? Where'd she come from?" And then they say, "Well, she's just the young Moabite woman." This Moabite theme keeps coming up in here. Why does he refer to her as a Moabite so often? And I think we see that at least 3 or 4 times in the first 2 chapters.
Why did he use the term, "Whose young woman is this?"
Oh, you... So you don't want to answer my question? You're going to
have a tougher one.
Go back to Jester.
Could we suppose that the
women
in the field were related to the reapers in some way?
Well, I take it to mean probably that, you know, she married. In other words, who does she belong to? Yeah, I mean, it could be and Christy and I were talking about this, and I think we brought it up a little bit. We're not, and somebody might know this. I don't know if Moab women look very much different than the Israelite women. I don't know if they had a different, a noticeable difference, but certainly they noticed that she was a foreigner. But I think that that idea of belonging, her husband, you know, belonging to someone is probably what he had in mind. Who does she belong to? Would be my guess. And then he just says, he's this young Moabite, and he repeats that again, that idea that she's a foreigner. So why do we keep seeing this? Why wouldn't it be enough? The beginning of this that sets the scene in the first five verses, we know what's happened here. We know that they went to Moab, they married these sons, married Moabite women, and then came back. And okay, so why do they keep saying Ruth the Moabite? Maybe, would you think maybe she would have preferred to just say Ruth and kind of forget the Moabite part? We realize the relationship with Israel and Moab is not a good one. Christy?
Maybe because in verse 12, where he says, under whose wings you have come for refuge, is taking up the contrast of who, where she is and who she is, because she's taking God as her, like she has said to Ruth, Naomi, I'm going to have the same God. Maybe that's a contrast, maybe?
Okay, yeah, you're taking refuge under the Lord as opposed to the gods or whatever you came
right.
from.
Right, and the other people, that is their gods, and she's a foreigner who wants to have this
relationship.
Come for refuge.
Yeah, she's come as a believer. She's declared her loyalty to Ruth, as we know from her famous statement in chapter 1. She's converted. She's become an Israelite, and is faithful to Naomi's God, God of heaven. No doubt about that. And Boaz picks that up. He knows that. Verse 11 tells us that he finds this out. And that's why when she says, why have I found favor in your eyes? Why have I found grace in your eyes? Basically, why have you taken notice of me? Because I'm a foreigner. And that theme just keeps coming up. What purpose does that serve in this narrative, Brady?
I don't know if you're getting at this. In fact, probably you're not. But I think part of this story reminds me about how she is redeemed, though she is not worthy or expected to be redeemed. She did nothing to deserve it. She's a complete foreigner, just kind of like the same way that we are.
Yeah.
And so if you make that application, then it would make sense, you know, to just concrete as you read through the scriptures that she is a Moabite. She's a, you know, not deserving of the grace that she is given by Boaz, as we are not deserving of the grace that we get for our own redemption.
No, I was getting at that.
Okay.
So that's the kind of the big idea. Because you've been to that. You said a different language.
Christy made me think of it.
I mean, the big thing, Boaz, as we'll see, as we've already seen, you know, God treats people with all this grace, even though they have nothing to give. She's in a position where she's got nothing to offer. She's a foreigner, and I think that's why that theme keeps coming up. I mean, that they want to get that down, that she can't really offer anything. She can go out in the field and glean and do what foreigners do. Boaz is going to give her a little more access to that, quite a bit more access to that, actually, because he has grace on her. But she's got nothing to give him at this point. So we see a lot. We see her character. How would you describe Ruth? Let's just kind of back up a step or two, just given what we've read, because we're going to get into Boaz in the next section here a little bit more deeply. But how would you describe Ruth here? What kind of things would come to mind? I have some question here. What are some words you describe Boaz? How about Ruth?
Right. Humble.
Humble, very humble, very humble.
I think we need to keep in mind how brave she is. Mm-hmm. Everything she has done is dangerous. Some might say almost suicidal. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Going to a foreign country, following a widow who has nothing anyway, going out of this field and the physical dangers to her mentioned a couple of times. She's a very brave woman.
Very courageous, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Woman of faith.
Woman of faith, yeah, she's got faith. And we've already seen her loyalty, right? Anything
hard
else?
Worker. Huh? Hard worker.
Really hard worker, right? That work ethic is kind of brought out in verse 7, and then later on when she has an ephah barley, how much is that? Anybody do some research on ephah?
3/5 of a bushel.
What's that?
3/5 of a bushel.
Yeah.
22 liters.
They've done some recent research on that, and they said it could be anything from 30 to 50 pounds that she had. So it was a bunch, and it enough to feed Naomi and her for a couple of weeks or more. And so she was energetic, hard worker, courageous, faithful, strong. She must have been pretty strong, and quite a little buddy. Reminds me of my wife.
So the, I mean, it's kind of caught up in a lot of the words that were just chosen just now, but I don't know why this time it stuck out to me a little bit more in verse 11 when he says, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. That made me think of, you know, what Jesus tells us we need to be willing to do, right? So, you know, leaving, we need to be able to separate ourselves from family if we need to be able to be loyal to God. There's loyalty, and then there's the brave thing. But she left her father and her mother and said, this is where I'm going to go.
Yeah, that's good. She's an alien in a foreign land. And we're actually supposed to live that way, aren't we? I mean, First Peter makes a big deal about that, about living as sojourners. We're not people who are making it. We sing about it. We have a song, right? This world is not my home. Do you ever go, you ever sing that song? Go, do I believe what I'm singing right now? This world is not my home. Am I real clear? Can I sing this with an absolute clear head? Say that's true. I mean, just something to think about, because it is easy for us to get nested in our and to make this our home. We have to kind of always be reminded. Have any of you had the experience where you've been a foreigner for a lengthy time in another place? Have you ever had that experience?
As an adult.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because you were. This was right from. You came from England, right?
I did.
And so this was for a while. That. Anybody else?
They talk funny over here.
Yeah. They talk funny. Now you talk funny. Yes.
I haven't been a foreigner in a foreign land, but I've been a newcomer to a foreign state, a foreign congregation, people that didn't know me. And I've got to tell you, it takes a long time before everyone in town knows you to be a virtuous woman. That's not something that happens overnight unless you are really, I mean, I think that really says something about her, that she came to town, and it doesn't seem like it's been a long time, but already people know of her, and she already has this virtuous reputation, and that's hard to come by, and I think it's really striking to me.
Yeah, good point. It's a small area, you know, relative to what we're used to, but even then, sometimes I've lived in tiny towns a few times in my life, and that just means everybody knows everybody, right? And so they know you, and they know good or bad, right? I mean, everybody knows that. So my experience was when I was in Hawaii, which was like a foreign country, when I was drafted and went to Hawaii, because I was in the Army, so in the Vietnam era, soldiers didn't have they didn't get the applause or whatever that we want to give them now. It was just the opposite. And so you wear the uniform, you're going to get made fun of and mocked and a lot of things back then. But even without that, even when I wasn't wearing that, there's a, anybody know what this little term means?
Yeah, I know what it means.
What that means? Howley?
He's an outsider.
Outsider, newcomer. But see, it's technically it's newcomer, but really what it is you don't belong here. That's how they use it. And they say it with a certain ring to it, like just one howley. You know, and you get that a lot. You get that a lot. What we're going to go into, I'm using this as kind of a transition here because you can imagine Ruth feeling that way and having that kind of feeling like a howling and kind of being in this foreign place and really looking for somebody to say something to her, to be nice to her, to give her some comfort just with words, and we'll get into more on that later. And that's when Boaz steps up and kind of fills that gap. For me, it was a couple of native guys that were living there that had been called into the army from the National Guard, the Hawaii National Guard, and Willis Chang and Melvin Mao. I'll never forget them because they took me under their wing and just treated me. And Melvin Mao let me use his little surf bug, you know, with the racks on top and stuff, and I could drive that around and feel like I was a... He made me feel like I belonged there, and both of those, Melvin Mao was in our wedding, actually. Willis Ching, I kind of lost track of him. He was really the first one. That's so important. I look back on that, and I think I mentioned this in a sermon not long ago, that I wish I could run these guys down, because now, as I'm more mature, thinking back on it, that was huge for me. That was very early on when I first got there. And they did this, and it really just lifted the whole burden up. It didn't matter what somebody said on the side. I didn't feel like a howling anymore because of the way they treated me. And I think what we're going to see with Boaz, that's where he comes in. He comes in there and starts talking to her, whatever his motives are, you know, that, I don't know. But that we'll get into that, but...
I was wondering if maybe Naomi was the first one who did that for Ruth, because... I think maybe she's the reason that people knew about how good Ruth was and maybe talked her up and made her feel good about herself, and maybe that's why, part of the reason why Ruth wanted to stay with her in the first place, because maybe her parents didn't, maybe they were allowed to be rid of her, I don't know, but at least she had Naomi and seemed to sneak all of her in that.
Yeah. Both of these, I think, women come back into Bethlehem because, and we're not real sure because we don't give a lot of information about this, but they both kind of come with no visible means of support and kind of at loose ends. And that's why Ruth, I think, takes the initiative to do what she does. It's clearly she's learned something quite a bit from Naomi. That's why when we talk about her being bitter back up in chapter 1, we're careful to say that she wasn't a bitter person. But she was going through a bitter time, and she said, "Call me bitter, call me Mara." But yeah, clearly she was her first kind of. But she wasn't in any position to do anything, you know. So you look for somebody from outside. I had a lot of friends in the same boat I was, you know, when I was in the army. But almost everybody was. They were all, you know, Hawaii was like a foreign country back then. I mean, it wasn't that even hadn't been a state that long. And hi, Ben.
Sorry,
he's gleaning. Anyway, I thought what we get here when we have Boaz to Ruth, and he says, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women." And he just kind of takes her under his wing, basically. In fact, the verse that Christy, I think, I had a question up here. Number 3, verse 12, "The Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That's interesting coming from him, because Boaz is the one that's now kind of doing that. So do we learn anything from that? He says he attributes to the Lord, but is the Lord doing it literally, or? Here, I'm going with that. It happens through people, right? He works through others.
Ben, Christy?
The verse that you've fed me, you've taken care of me. And when did you do that? Well,
yeah, Matthew 25, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we didn't know, when Christ says that, he says, I didn't know we fed you and clothed you and visited you when you're in prison all the time, but when you've done it to the least of one of these, you've done it to me. So there's that. God doesn't just work in, you know, some magic on people. He works through people, and that's brought out hear very clearly in what he says. How about, okay, so let's, how would you describe Boaz? We talked about Ruth a little bit. Just some words again that describe Boaz. Just on the surface here from what we've got.
He's a godly man.
He's a godly man. Kind of see that in his, back up in that section, in verse 4, chapter 2, verse 4, when he comes onto the scene.
He's greedy.
Yeah, Yahweh greet you. Yahweh be with you. And they answered, Yahweh bless you. And then, what else? What other characteristics did he have? What words might you?
Honorable.
Honorable. I like that word, honorable. We had a whole class in our, when we were studying Philippians in our Sunday afternoon class, we're going to study Philippians 4:8 and talk about all the words there, and we got kind of hung up on honorable. We talked almost the whole hour about it, because we don't talk about that much. Stop and think about it. What does that mean? Honorable. I think it came up because we were talking about something else, and I remember saying, well, he had no honor. And I think we know what that means when we say that in the context we say, but what is honor?
Sort of like loyalty to some kind of code or mantra. It's like you're steadfast to some kind of moral.
Yes. Yeah, good. You kind of... Yeah, you got a moral center, right? It's certainly part of being honorable is that you're operating from principles, not on a whim or just whatever suits you at the time. It's something. So you're going to do the honorable thing no matter what, right? No matter the circumstances. That's certainly one major part of it. What else? Christy, what do you want to say?
The thing I think about is a military person who does the honorable thing and keeps going back to help a comrade or keeps doing the honor, and they reward those types of people with Bronze Stars and the Medal of Honor and things. But a Medal of Honor is just given just to very few people.
Right.
But it's something that, we said, it's a quote, a code of something that you feel very strongly about.
Right.
That you do no matter what or who is watching.
Yeah. Your honor is something that you either are or aren't. Doesn't matter what the external circumstances are, who sees it, who doesn't see it. It's what you, it's that. That kind of goes back to what you said about kind of sticking to one thing. And, you know, everybody that gets out of the army almost gets an honorable discharge. The only other option is to get a dishonorable discharge, which nobody wants. But honorable means you did what you were supposed to do when you're in there. And it's kind of lightens up the word a little bit, in my opinion, but because it does go deeper than that. And of course, we're not just talking about men. Boaz was honorable, but so is Ruth. She's an honorable woman. She's a virtuous woman, an honorable woman. Just a word to think about. I mean, we had a long conversation about that just because we started thinking of how that applies, and it's not one we talk a lot about. We talk more about some other stuff. I remember Will telling me that a soldier without, that was after I did a sermon on a shield, I was using a shield as an analogy and whatever, and he came up out and said, a soldier without his shield is without honor. Anybody know why? I had to look it up. Soldier without shield is without honor. Because the shield... With your shield, you're guarding the whole line. If you lose your shield, now you're exposing the whole line. You have the line of here, and you keep your shield. If you lose your helmet, you know, you lose some part, that's one thing. But you keep that shield. And he's without honor. That's one thing you don't ever let go of. Because your whole line could fall apart. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But I had to learn that from my grandson. So, which is okay. Okay, so we have Boaz, who's an honorable man. He's a faithful man. He's certainly a good man. He's a gracious person, right, Brian?
I think there are good lessons for us from Boaz as a supervisor. We alluded to this a little bit on Sunday, but he's aware, he notices that there's a new person there and asks about her,
yeah.
And he eats with the workers. He doesn't seem to elevate himself, management, so to speak. He goes out of his way to make her feel welcome, and then he's got the protective element about don't touch her. And so I think for all of us, there's good lessons from Boaz as a supervisor.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Verse 14, in fact, I had that in a question here about what clues are there in verse 14, and that you brought those out. The fact that he's sitting there with his workers and not above them or, you know, apart from them. There's something called, and I heard this when I was in the business world, something called professional distance, you know, that supervisors theoretically kind of keep. So they're not. It's very strict in the military. You can't fraternize with officers and enlisted men. You're not supposed to fraternize. It was interesting when you're in Hawaii and there were officers and enlisted men in the church. And of course, we weren't in uniform. Nobody saluted anybody in the church. It kind of was almost an analogy for the way things are supposed to be, because we had no rank in the. But then we got. If I saw them on the base, I would have to, you know. In fact, I got the Volkswagen that the captain left behind. So they had to salute me when I, because they had the sticker.
It's a sticker.
So when I went through the gate, they saluted me. I just saluted them back. but I was just an E4, but they didn't know that.
When I was in high school, I got saluted. Because Grandpa Al's car has a captain on it.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
That's what
makes you feel kind of good.
Yeah, captain.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, he was a Navy captain.
Yeah, captain. Captain Davis, big
rank. Where were we? Oh, yeah. So yeah, he's a really good example of the kind of the anti-boss. You know, somebody that's, because we think of a boss, somebody wants to keep control and kind of maintain this persona of control and power. And he doesn't seem to reflect that at all. Ben, did you have it?
Well, I was going back on the honorable, but on that, I think that's what makes an honorable person is somebody who's not just looking in front of them. They see the whole picture. And so he sees that in his workers. And I think even when he's dealing with Ruth, he's seeing Naomi and that giving Naomi honor. I mean, you wouldn't give as much extra as he would, I don't think, if it was just Ruth. I think he realizes Ruth is collecting for their little family unit.
Probably
and in fact, even the roasted grain gave her enough to where she was satisfied, and plus there is enough leftovers for her to take home to Naomi as well.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think that was on purpose. It had to have been, you know, to knowing the circumstances that they were in. So I think an honorable person, the kind of person we're talking about, is cognizant of that and thinks about those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's different than the word we use today is somebody who's calculated. Somebody these days, that's kind of almost the opposite of an honorable person, is somebody who's calculated, what am I going to get out of whatever I'm doing? What advantage am I going to get out of these? And that's not how an honorable person operates.
Yeah, as the proverb talks about, you invite the person over to eat with you, and then you... You say, he's eating all our food. He's it's like, Janet?
The word that we haven't said, but I think is encompassed by a lot of these descriptions, is kind. He's showing her kindness. I can't imagine someone who's the owner of a business noticing some newcomer who's not... A worker for him.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like she's a worker of his. She's coming to glean off of his land, and he has to go way out of his way and he shows kindness to her because he sees that she has this need and that he can help her, and so he helps her.
Right. No. Right. And we'll talk more about that because The Hebrew word hesed is in here in the next section especially. I have a question on that in the next one. But his kindness is certainly a huge, and really summarizes, I think, everything that he is. I mean, that term's important, and that word, Hebrew word, has added importance. We'll talk about that. We'll be talking about that on Sunday. But, yeah.
One thing about Boaz is that he recognized if he had just given Ruth the grain, that would be like her begging. Instead, he gives her she can maintain her dignity and by her working for what she thought was reasonable, but he was able to provide extra for her without her losing her dignity and being a beggar, but by laying out a little extra.
Yeah, telling his workers to put a little, making it easier on her.
Yeah.
He probably, he knows how hard she worked. I mean, he actually, his overseer said that, and that she worked from here to here, and it was a little short break, you know, and so she was really a hard worker. Her work ethic is really something. So he does that, and he's just extremely kind to her, and the word encouragement obviously comes to mind. He's encouraging her, and that's what she needed. She had courage, as was pointed out. But what's that word encourage mean, actually? I mean, break it apart. What does that mean? She exhibited courage, as Scott said, right, by going out there in the first place. We tried to keep this in the historical context. This is the time of the judges. We're told that in verse 1. We have to keep that in mind. So that makes that going out, that courageous point, a little more, you know, significant.
To me, encourage is to make someone feel comfortable, to encourage them to move forward. Mm-hmm. With some ease.
Yeah, and even in the face of difficulty, right? In the face of a trial, we would think, if I encourage you to, and we see it again, there's good military analogies with this, because there's somebody encouraging, you know, the others to keep moving forward in the face of gunfire. I mean, how do those guys get out of those amphibious vehicles, you know, those boats, D-Day, and just run into the gunfire? I mean, courage had to be built in, and then that was expressed through their actions. And so he was encouraging. Who in the New Testament is known as the encourager?
Barnabas.
Barnabas, son of encouragement. Acts 4:26. That's what he was called. That would be a nickname that, you know, most of us would like to have.
Right? They could also translate it as son of exaltation.
Son of exaltation, yeah. Kind of exalt you or exhort you to the
exaltation. Exaltation.
Exaltation.
Exaltation.
Yippee, 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 yippee. Exhortation. Yeah, so it does, so that kind of brings us to another thing, and that is the words he uses and the words he speaks to her. How does she reflect on that? How does Ruth reflect on that? These words, other than Naomi, these words that Boaz speaks to her may have been the only time she really received kind words, at least overtly kind words that are expressed to her. How does she characterize that?
Surprise,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, she was...
I wrote that too, that he spoke gently to her.
Mm-hmm. She says in verse 13, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am one of your servants. She comforted me. Lexi one time was talking about somebody when she was little, and she said, her words didn't comfort me. And I was thinking, knowing who it was, we knew that that probably was true, you know, that she spoke kind of harshly to her. And this is the boss man, you know, this is the man who's control, and he's the one that's doing this kindly speech. And she was, I liked your point that it was a bit of surprise to her, you know, yet. And again, it goes back to her humility. She didn't feel like she deserves this. And so this is such a... This book, of course, is a story of grace. That's what it is. And I think that's the bigger story. I think it's the kind of nugget of the whole thing. Boaz shows her grace, and Boaz shows Naomi grace, Naomi has shown Ruth grace, and Ruth has shown Naomi Grace and all of that. And then it just all it permeates the whole thing. So let's talk about that a minute. What is the power of words? What can you do just with a word? Bad or good?
Either.
Both. It can go either way, right? And it can do with a word. Oh, I know how you feel. What if somebody just lost a child and you never lost a child and you go up and say that kind of thing? Just saying the wrong thing. Yeah, you know, a lot of people, I told you this, I told you this before, when my, not knowing up, the week my mom died, you know what I'm talking about, but I got a note from a young preacher who said, I know how you feel, my cat died. And I just, that was so bizarre that I just was, whoa, that's kind of interesting. And I actually wrote him because he's a preacher. And I said, you know, especially as a preacher, you kind of got to keep your, you got to kind of think about this before you send messages like that out. But people do that kind of thing all the time. And it's, so there, we understand the damaging effect of words. We have to be very careful with what we say. They're probably, if you went around the room, we wouldn't do this. If you went around the room, everybody could probably, they probably got words in their head that somebody said to you at some point that they're in there and come back to you every now and then. I hope positive and but also negative. There are things that stick in there that somebody said to you that hurt you pretty deeply or, you know, whatever. So, or maybe encouraged you. Gracious words, what's Proverbs 16:24? Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. I actually wrote that out and I was able to read it. That's unusual. But so what are gracious words? Christy?
Careful of the words you speak and keep them sweet. Is that how it goes?
Something like that.
Because you never know which ones you have to eat.
Yeah.
Keep them sweet.
Yeah. Do you think that more damage has been done by words than maybe anything else? Mm-hmm. You go back and look.
Yes. James says that.
Yeah. James talks about speech and the forest fire that can be kindled and the, it's like a little rudder, the tongue is this and that, and it's kind of scary, actually. And you can tame any beast, but you can't tame the tongue. Kind of negative view of it, but it's kind of
but
true.
But he still asks us to do it.
We still have to do it. We need to...
Nobody asks. God expects us to do it, even though James just said you can't do it, so that...
No. Now you get the chair out, and you get the whip, and you just what you're doing with that tongue. And of course, all of us who are parents, you know, we've said things to our kids that we'd like to take back, I'm sure. And maybe sometimes the kids say stuff, I don't know about this, but I'm sure at some point in their life they may say something to their parents they'd like to take back. I've got my share of that kind of stuff, you know, with different people. So, what are some of the hints of the gospel in this? I think we probably talked about this, but we've got 5 minutes, I think. Are there, what do you see in this section that we've talked about here?
I wrote down last week about how I could ask myself, what have I gleaned today?
Yes, yes. You can get that gleaning word out of prayers and into the regular life, you know. What have you gleaned?
Keyed on that word redeemer. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a redeemer. Redeems all of this. They were specific people under this system, but we have a redeemer who redeems everyone.
So Boaz is a Christ figure or prototype in that regard, and even in what he's doing here and the way he's treating this foreigner. Like, did we ever answer the question why he keeps saying Moabite? We get to that, right? Because the narrator is emphasizing this person is in this position. That needs to be, you know, that typically in that situation, that setting, that person would not be treated properly. And taking that into the gospel setting, what do we deserve? we're foreigners to start with.
We're enemies.
Yeah, I mean, we're supposed to be there only in the kingdom, right? We're supposed to be foreigners in the kingdom. We're foreigners before we come into the kingdom because we're alienated from God, and so we need His grace. That's how we're saved. And again, that just seems to permeate this. That's the key of this when we make a gospel application to it.
Something I kind of noticed is that in the first two chapters, she's referred to by as the Moabitess, mm-hmm. or Moabite multiple Moabite. Times, and then foreigner. And then in chapter 3, and throughout most of the 4, that never happens again. Yeah. Until the very end, when the women say, Ruth the Moabite was, however they say it, but, you know, she was taken in and... you know, blessed and taken in by Boaz. However they say it at the very end, I have to go find it. I don't have it anymore. But through 3 and 4, it doesn't come up again.
Yeah.
Until the very end when they're commenting on Ruth being brought into the... by Boaz.
4:10, yeah.
I have it in 4:5 and 4:10.
4:5 and 4:10? Uh-huh. Yeah. You also acquire Ruth. Oh, that's when Boaz is talking to the nearer redeemer, and he says, if you get the lamb, you also can get her, the Moabite. So I think that's just descriptive in that case, just giving him some information.
And then he brings up in 10, he says, and Ruth the Moabite, too, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance. But I don't know, I just thought it interesting.
Yeah, no, it's prominent in the first...
During the redeeming process, that's not...
And she's redeemed, right? She's no longer a foreigner.
Grace.
Another angle for the tying into the gospel and God's plan is here is Ruth the Moabite who is in the lineage of Christ, right? And she's listed in Matthew. And I think that's part of the aha, right? I mean, the writer puts the lineage of David at the end for a reason. This woman who you would not think would be in the lineage of a king is not only in the lineage of the greatest physical king Israel is going to have, but she is in the lineage of Christ.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of... Yeah, one can argue that that's one of the main purposes of this book is to get that, kind of fill that gap. I mean, there's other purposes, but that's certainly... one of them. And we mentioned that Ruth is one of those. Ruth and Rahab, who is Boaz's mother, those women, as well as three others, are mentioned, all have a bit of a, what I would call a taint, in from the Jewish standpoint anyway. They shouldn't be in there, you know, and they are. And that's a message too, you know. I mean, there's a lot of those kind of below the surface messages that kind of percolate up as we look a little bit deeper into these texts. So, all right, thank you. We're going to finish out chapter 2 on Sunday, or we're going to start finishing it out.